Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, October 8th, 2021. U.S. creates 194,000 new jobs in September. It's a smaller number than a lot of analysts expected, but the unemployment rate falls to 4.8%. That's a point that President Joe Biden highlights. With the U.S. Senate's passage Thursday night of a two-month debt limit extension and the House scheduling a vote for the deal next week, the threat of economic disruption from a default on the debt is gone in the short term. But some new questions about the future party cooperation after Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's speech before the debt limit increase vote is criticized by many Republicans and some Democrats. White House officials denying an attempt by former President Donald Trump to claim executive privilege on documents requested by Congress related to the January 6th attack on the Capitol. A legal fight is likely. President Joe Biden restoring protections to large tracts of federal land national monuments in Utah, undoing a decision by former President Trump that opened the areas to mining and development. Also restoring protections to a marine monument off the coast of New England in the Atlantic Ocean that had been opened by former President Trump to fishing. And Secretary of State Antony Blinken meeting with the President of Mexico in Mexico City as the two countries begin a joint security cooperation agreement. Now to the jobs report, this from CNBC. The U.S. economy created jobs at a much slower than expected pace in September, a pessimistic sign about the state of the economy, though the total was held back substantially by a sharp drop in government employment. Non-farm payrolls rose by just 194,000 in the month, compared with the Dow Jones estimate of 500,000, the Labor Department reported Friday. Unemployment rate fell to 4.8%, better than the expectation for 5.1%, and the lowest since February 2020. And the headline number was hurt by that 123,000 decline in government payrolls, while private payrolls increased by 317,000. That from CNBC. President Biden speaking about the jobs report in the Eisenhower Executive Office building.
Today, for the first time since March of 2020, the American unemployment rate is below 5%. In just 8 months since I became president, in the midst of a grave public health and economic crisis, the unemployment rate is now down below 5% at 4.8%. Let me just repeat that. Today's report has the unemployment rate down to 4.8%, a significant improvement from when I took office and a sign that our recovery is moving forward, even in the face of a COVID pandemic. That improvement was widespread. Unemployment for Hispanic workers was down, and the unemployment rate for African Americans fell almost a full percent, and it's now below 8% for the first time in 17 months, a drop of 496,000 in long-term unemployment is the second largest single month drop since we started keeping records. The largest was in July. So in the past 3 months, we've seen a drop of 1.3 million long-term unemployed. That's the largest 3 months fall in long-term unemployment since we started keeping records in 1948. More to do, but great progress. And working Americans are seeing their paychecks go up as well. In September, we saw one of the largest increases in average wages paid to workers on working Americans on record. Today's report comes one day after the Labor Department found in the third quarter of this year, the number of layoffs and job reductions was the lowest in this country since 1997. Overall, the unemployment report shows almost 200,000 jobs were created last month, over 300,000 in the private sector and 26,000 in manufacturing, offset by some seasonal adjustments in education and hiring. The monthly totals bounce around, but if you take a look at the trend, it's solid. On average, 600,000 new jobs created every month since I took office. And in 3 months before I got there, that was one-tenth what was being created. It's 60,000 as opposed to 600,000 jobs a month. In total, the job creation in the first 8 months of my administration is nearly 5 million jobs. Jobs up, wages up, unemployment down. That's progress. And it's a tribute to the hard work and resilience of the American people who are battling through this pandemic, working to keep their businesses afloat. Remember, today's report is based on a survey that was taken during the week of September the 13th. Not today, September the 13th. when COVID cases were averaging more than 150,000 per day. Since then, we've seen the daily cases fall by more than one third, and they're continuing to trend down. We're continuing to make progress.
President Joe Biden in the Eisenhower Executive Office building. He mentioned the unemployment rate dropping below 5%. Yahoo Finance writes that that came alongside an unexpected drop in the labor force participation rate, which ticked down to 61.6% from August's 61.7%. President Biden also taking the opportunity to again make a pitch for the two big spending bills, still in negotiations before Congress, the $1.2 trillion for infrastructure and $3.5 trillion for social welfare and climate programs. The Labor Secretary Marty Walsh was interviewed this morning on Fox Business Channel about the labor, about the jobs report. Lead paragraph in the accompanying article at foxbusiness.com includes this. Walsh blamed the COVID-19 pandemic on September's disappointing jobs report, which was released on Friday, saying the Delta variant affected economic activity and therefore job growth. Here's a portion of that interview.
This report that we're looking at today is a complex report, and I don't think it's as bad as what everyone's reporting. We look at the sectors. Obviously, we had 194,000 jobs, 317,000 in the private sector. We saw gains in manufacturing and retail that are good to see. In some other areas, the hospitality number, we about 74,000 job gain there. Unfortunately, it's under what people projected, and that's there's a direct correlation to the rise in the Delta variant. Also, in the educational sector, there's something going on there that we have to do some more research on, particularly the educational public sector number. I think a lot of people expected with school starting that we'd see that number a lot higher, and certainly that's the number was in some cases not as disappointing. I'll say it was disappointing.
Labor Secretary Marty Walsh on Fox Business Channel. Congressman Kevin Brady, top Republican on the Ways and Means Committee, tweeting, "No economist dream Biden's jobs numbers could be worse than August, but even with dumbed-down expectations, they are. If this was a football team with this losing record, the coach would be searching for a new job at this point." And a tweet from the Republican National Committee Chair Ronna McDaniel, "Today's jobs report is a disaster. Over 300,000 fewer jobs created than expected. Labor force participation fell. Prices are rising faster than wages. Biden has squandered the recovery he inherited." Wall Street reaction, the Dow down 8, NASDAQ down 74, S&P down 8. This from Newsweek, video of Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia, holding his head in his hands while listening to Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, give a speech about the debt limit, has garnered more than 100,000 views on Twitter. Schumer delivered a speech from the Senate floor on Thursday that was highly critical of Republicans and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, following a near last-minute deal to raise the debt ceiling and avert a potential U.S. default. Though it was not immediately clear if Manchin's gesture was a sign of fatigue or an indication of displeasure with Schumer's remarks, the West Virginia senator later criticized the speech in remarks to reporters. That reporting from Newsweek. Here is some of what Senator Schumer said Thursday night.
"In a few moments, the Senate will pass an extension of the debt limit through early December, avoiding a first-ever Republican-manufactured default on the national debt. On Monday morning, I said we needed to pass a bill to address the debt limit by the end of the week, and that is exactly what we did. Republicans played a dangerous and risky partisan game, and I am glad that their brinksmanship did not work. For the good of America's families, for the good of our economy, Republicans must recognize in the future that they should approach fixing the debt limit in a bipartisan way. What is needed now is a long-term solution, so we don't go through this risky drama every few months. And we hope Republicans will join in enacting a long-term solution to the debt limit in December. We're ready to work with them." Leader McConnell and Senate Republicans insisted they wanted a solution to the debt ceiling, but said Democrats must raise it alone by going through a drawn-out, convoluted and risky reconciliation process. That was simply unacceptable to my caucus. And yesterday, Senate Republicans finally realized that their obstruction was not going to work. I thank my Democratic colleagues for showing our unity in solving this Republican manufactured crisis.
The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer on the Senate floor Thursday night before that vote to raise the debt ceiling for 2 months through early December. It passed along party lines 50-48, but it came after the key vote to limit debate that required 60 votes to pass. It got 61. 11 Republicans joined the Democrats in that procedural vote. After Senator Schumer's remarks, Politico reporting what it called the GOP blowback, quoting Whip John Thune, saying his speech was totally out of line. I mean, he crossed lines and it was inappropriate and tone deaf, and I told him that. And there is video of Senator Thune confronting Senator Schumer on the floor. Also this from Senator Mitt Romney. There's a time to be graceful and there's a time to be combative. That was a time for grace and common ground. Reaction from Republicans. Democratic Senator Joe Manchin also critical of Senator Schumer. Senator Manchin spoke with reporters as he left the Capitol building.
I didn't think it was appropriate at this time. We had talk about that, but he felt charged up, and he and I had good conversations.
Why was not it appropriate?
I just think that basically what we got to do is find a pathway forward to make sure that we de-weaponize. Mm-hmm. We have to de-weaponize. You can't be playing politics. None of us can on both sides, okay? Mm-hmm. And both sides have been very guilty of this, and the frustration was built up. And I'm sure Chuck's frustration was built, but that was not a way to take it out. We just disagree. I'd done it differently.
We heard from a couple of Republicans who said that was a counterproductive speech. And so are you worried?
Well, on both sides, I'm just saying, it's just the civility is gone, okay? And I'm not going to be part of getting rid of it. I'm going to try to bring it back, and I speak out when I see someone do something I don't like.
We heard you refer to this as an effing embarrassing speech.
Oh, I never said that, do I? That's John.
Okay, so
you're confusing me with my good friend John Tester from
Montana. Senator, in December, this is going to be so much harder to do. Look, this is a
No, we're going to make
it happen. How are you going to do it? Because you are going to oppose still any changes to the filibuster rules, right?
Yeah, I'm not going to do that. We can do it without. I think both of them know how critical this is. We can't go down this path, and we can't play with the good faith. I mean, the faith and confidence of this whole beautiful country of ours that we won't pay our bills.
So then how are you going to do it? I mean, has that been done through reconciliation?
I think that if we can get everybody together, calm down a little bit, get everybody together, and understand that it's best for both sides. You can fight about a lot of things, mm-hmm. but you don't throw this out. This is the most serious thing we can do, and we're not going to do it anymore. And I said, remember I told you before, we were not going to default, and we did not default, and we will not default and go through this again. We'll work it out.
Reconciliation, should your party go through reconciliation to do this?
I have a difference. I think that reconciliation would not have hurt us, but I understand that there's a lot of people that don't want to, and there's a difference of opinion on that. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is, we shouldn't have to go through reconciliation. We should both agree that this is too serious for any of us to get in trouble with mm-hmm. and to play with.
But Ed, you will just 100% not agree to a carve-out of the filibuster
guys. I mean, the filibuster is the only thread that we have to keep democracy alive and well in America. It keeps us the body that we are. It makes us, even when you see kind of this go on, it's still a realization we have to work together. That's all. If we didn't have the filibuster to where it could keep us coming back to civility from time to time, then you would see total chaos.
Mm-hmm. Is Mitch McConnell asking you not to do that? I mean, you talk a lot.
No. Well, I talk with everybody. I talk with Mitch as much as I do anybody else. I feel very comfortable talking. And you have to. Communication is the name of the game here. That's why we're the deliberate body. You can't be a deliberate body if you don't communicate. You got to communicate.
Senator, after you communicate with Biden today, do you think the October 31st deadline on reconciliation is possible? Is that possible?
We'll work everything out, guys.
Do you think October 31st is possible?
You have a good break. Okay? You've earned it. All of you earned it.
And that's Senator Joe Manchin closing his car door outside the U.S. Capitol building as he walked out last night after the votes with reporters. The video posted by CNN reporter Manu Raju. A question about all this today to the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki during her daily briefing.
Is that something, you know, it seems like he will be able to sign a short-term suspension of that. Are there any conversations about trying to avoid the situation that Congress faced this week so that it doesn't happen again in December, or is the focus primarily on the two pieces of legislation?
Well, I think there's no question our preference this week, last week, and in the future would be to fully address the debt limit and not put the American people in a position where they are worrying about their retirement savings, their Social Security payments to members of the military moving forward. So we would like to have a longer-term solution, there's no question. Well, it took us some time to get there through a little blood, sweat, and tears. Well, not blood, but sweat and tears, perhaps. You know, we are, what last night showed is that this can happen through regular order. And obviously, our preference would have been longer term, but there was a short-term extension. It happened through regular order. We're going to continue to press to raise the debt limit and do it as it has been done in the past in a bipartisan fashion.
One last on that. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer gave a speech after it passed. Senator Manchin and some Republicans criticized that speech. Does the White House have any response to kind of the words that the leader used on the Senate floor?
Well, we also issued our own statement, so I'd point you to the tone of that statement as to what our view is. But I would say that our view continues to be that Leader Schumer has shown great skill in navigating this process through a challenging process. We have confidence in his ability to do that moving forward. And I think it's important to remember that the reason we were teetering on the edge of default in an economic calamity is because Republicans were refusing to join with Democrats or even to allow Democrats to be the adults in the room and raise the debt limit themselves.
The White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. As for the next step, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer scheduling a vote on this debt ceiling increase compromise passed by the Senate. And that vote in the House scheduled for Tuesday, October 12th. They're bringing the House back from recess a week early to take the vote. Rollcall.com writes that a vote in the House could be tricky given Republican opposition to the short-term patch and Democrats in that chamber barely backing a longer suspension of the debt limit late last month. Republican Congressman Brian Stile of Wisconsin interviewed today on Newsmax. He says that the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell should have never made the deal in the first place.
Yeah, I don't understand Mitch McConnell's strategy. I think when this bill comes to the House, I don't think you're going to see any Republican votes in support of raising the debt ceiling at all. What we're doing is watching Washington, D.C. kick the can down the road rather than dealing with the spending situation that's before us. American people are seeing prices going up, whether or not it's at the gas pump, the grocery store, or back to school shopping. They're seeing that because we have runaway spending in Washington, D.C. We saw a bad jobs report out today, again, I think impacted by runaway spending in Washington, D.C. I'd like to see the Republicans in the House stand firm and say no to this rise in the debt ceiling, in particular because we need to hold Democrats accountable for what they're doing to the U.S. economy.
Congressman Brian Stile on Newsmax. Again, the vote in the House set for Tuesday, October 12th. The House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer, Democrat of Maryland, put out a statement when he scheduled that vote. And he said, due to the fact that Senate Republicans refused to advance House passed legislation to responsibly raise the debt limit and chose to put the United States' full faith and credit at risk, the Senate has passed a temporary stopgap measure, and the House will be required to meet next week to act on this legislation. It is egregious that our nation has been put in this spot, but we must take immediate action to address the debt limit and ensure the full faith and credit of the United States remains intact. Of course, we will cover the floor debate live, gavel to gavel, on the C-SPAN networks. This from NBC News. The White House on Friday formally blocked an attempt by former President Donald Trump to withhold documents from Congress related to the January 6th attack on the Capitol, setting up a legal showdown between the current and former presidents over executive privilege. We head back to the White House briefing with Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
Can you confirm that the White House is authorizing the National Archives to turn over documents covering all communications related to Trump's activities on January 6th?
The administration takes the events of January 6th incredibly seriously, as the president said on its six-month anniversary. That day posed an existential crisis and a test of whether our democracy could survive. It was in many respects a unique attack on the foundations of our democracy. The president's dedicated to ensuring that something like that could never happen again, which is why the administration is cooperating with ongoing investigations, including the January 6th Select Committee, to bring to light what happened. As a part of this process, the president has determined determined that an assertion of executive privilege is not warranted for the first set of documents from the Trump White House that have been provided to us by the National Archives. As we've said previously, this will be an ongoing process, and this is just the first set of documents. And we will evaluate questions of privilege on a case-by-case basis, but the President has also been clear that he believes it to be of the utmost importance for both Congress and the American people to have a complete understanding of the events of that day to prevent them from happening again.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. Also this on a related matter from the New York Times. The Select Committee investigating the January 6th Capitol riot threatened on Friday to pursue criminal charges against Stephen K. Bannon, the former chief strategist to President Donald J. Trump, for refusing to comply with its subpoena, announcing it would consider initiating criminal contempt of Congress proceedings. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today, which you can get as a podcast on the C-SPAN Now mobile app or wherever you get your podcasts. From the Associated Press, President Joe Biden is restoring two sprawling national monuments in Utah, reversing a decision by President Donald Trump that opened for mining and development some Red Rock lands sacred to Native Americans and home to ancient cliff dwellings and petroglyphs. President also making another announcement about a marine monument in the Atlantic Ocean. Here's the president on the north lawn of the White House.
Today, I am proud to announce the protection and expansion of three of the most treasured national monuments, our most treasured. Based on powers granted to the president under the Antiquities Act, first used more than a century ago by Teddy Roosevelt. First, Bears Ears National Monument in Utah. This is the first national monument in the country to be established at the request of federally recognized tribes. And a place of healing, as was spoken by the secretary, a place of reverence, a sacred homeland to hundreds of generations of Native peoples. The last administration reduced the size by 85%, leaving vulnerable more than 1 million acres of cherished landscape. Today, we shall surely be signing a proclamation to fully restore the boundaries of Bears Ears. And second, I'm restoring Utah's Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, a place of unique and extraordinary geology as well as biodiversity, established as a national monument 25 years ago this month. Over the last quarter century, this land has produced a significant scientific discoveries per acre than more than any other national monument, everything from fossils to ancient indigenous artifacts. And once again, the last administration cut the size of the monument nearly in half, stripping away more than 800,000 protected acres. Today, I'm signing a proclamation to restore it to its full glory. Third, off the coast of New England, I'm restoring protection of the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts Marine National Monument. Waters teeming with life, with underwater canyons as deep as parts of the Grand Canyon and underwater mountains as tall as the Appalachians. There's nothing like it in the world. Because its unique biodiversity, marine scientists believe that this is a key to understanding life under the sea. President Obama established it as a national monument 5 years ago, recognizing its irreplaceable value. Again, my predecessor chipped away at its protections. The proclamation I'll be signing today is going to restore protections established by President Obama when this monument was first created. Excuse me. The protection of public lands must not become a pendulum that swings back and forth depending on who's in public office. It's not a partisan issue.
President Biden on the lawn outside the White House. His authority to create and alter national monuments from federal lands, as he's doing and also as former President Trump did, it comes from the 1906 Antiquities Act, which gives the power to protect significant natural, cultural, and scientific features on those federal lands. Joining the president today was the Interior Secretary, Deb Haaland, who was the first Native American to serve in a president's cabinet, and she spoke specifically about the Utah monuments.
We are here today on the ancestral homelands of the Anacostan and Piscataway people, bending the arc of the moral universe toward justice. Thank you, Mr. President, for the profound action you are taking today to permanently protect the homelands of our ancestors. Our songs, our languages, and our cultures are strong, and many people from many Indian tribes have sung and spoken in unison to protect this sacred place. Bears Ears is a living landscape. When I've been there, I felt the warmth and joy of ancestors who've cared for this special place since time immemorial. It's a place where you can stand in the doorway of a home where a family who lived thousands of years ago left behind a legacy of love and conservation for a place that sustained them for countless generations. Stories of existence, celebration, survival, and reverence are etched into the sandstone canyon walls. Sacred sites are dotted across the desert mesas. Cultural heritage in the form of ancient pots, arrowheads, clothing, seeds, and evidence of lives well lived are as inseparable from Bears Ears as the air we breathe at this moment. Today, children learn and sustain from their parents and elders the songs, traditions, and ceremonies that have been passed down from generation to generation at Bears Ears. This is a place that must be protected in perpetuity for every American and every child of the world.
Interior Secretary Deb Haaland joining the president outside the White House for that announcement. The Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante monuments in Utah encompass more than 3.2 million acres. That is nearly the size of Connecticut. Ahead of today's announcement, Ryan Zinke, who was Interior Secretary under President Donald Trump, posting this video.
Well, I heard President Biden today is expected to not only reverse our decision on monuments in Utah, but in fact, enlarge them. Now, this is despite the entirety of the Utah congressional delegation, the governor, the people of Utah have expressly said that monuments should, A, follow the law. That means smallest area to protect the object. And B, it should have an object in it. But when monuments become a political agenda, as they were in Bears Ears, look, we reverted 800,000 acres of wilderness back to wilderness on Bears Ears. We made the recommendation to convert an entire national forest back to a national forest. Because traditional uses, hunting, fishing, cattle, traditional uses of the land are important too. So when you look at that, to reverse that decision and make the monuments larger, that's a slap in the face of trying to work with states, communities. That's why we have to stop the radical agenda. God bless.
Ryan Zinke, former Interior Secretary in the Trump administration, also a former Republican congressman from Montana, tweeting that video. The governor of Utah, Spencer Cox, a Republican, expressing disappointment in President Biden's decision to restore the Utah monuments and has suggested in the past there could be legal action to try to stop this. Secretary of State Antony Blinken leading a delegation to Mexico City to meet with the Mexican president, Andres Manuel López Obrador, and other Mexican leaders, part of the Biden administration's first U.S.-Mexico high-level security dialogue. Reuters reports that this is in which the two countries will negotiate a sweeping new agreement on how to tackle everything from drug flows to the United States to the smuggling of U.S.-made guns into Mexico. Secretary Blinken making these opening remarks.
I know I speak for all my colleagues when I say how pleased we are to launch this new framework. After 13 years of the Merida Initiative, it's time for a comprehensive new approach to our security cooperation, one that will see us as equal partners in defining our shared priorities, tackle the root drivers of these challenges, like inequity, like corruption, and focus not only on strengthening law enforcement, but also public health, the rule of law, inclusive economic opportunities. Our countries are connected by vast economic, cultural, and family ties. And we also share a commitment to give all of our people a free, peaceful, and prosperous future. For that, we need security. Transnational criminal organizations continue to threaten communities throughout both of our countries. They're responsible for most of the illicit drugs and contraband trafficked into the United States, as well as into Mexico, and a great deal of violence and insecurity here as well. Both of our presidents have named as priorities pursuing criminal networks, preventing transborder crime, protecting our people. To do that, we have to do more to disrupt arms and narcotics trafficking and human smuggling, to strengthen border and port security, to dismantle the financial systems that sustain organized crime, and to root out impunity and to hold accountable human rights abusers, and critically, to address public health issues of addiction, which fuel the drug trade, cause enormous pain for families and communities, and fuel demand as well. These are national security issues. They're law enforcement issues, and they're justice issues, because supporting the rule of law, combating corruption, promoting human rights will be woven throughout all of the work we're doing. And again, that's why there's not just a Secretary of State, but a Secretary of Homeland Security, an Attorney General, a Deputy Treasury Secretary here today, because all of our departments are committed to this effort, working with our counterparts. Let me just add that criminal organizations are constantly adapting techniques. They're making the most of new technologies. So we need to adapt as well. We need to be just as creative and nimble. This new security dialogue promises to drive that innovative approach. Most of all, we have to be fully committed to this fight and fully committed to our cooperation, because these are challenges that Mexico and the United States can only solve working together as partners with shared responsibility. We know that drug trafficking and other transnational crime aren't just flowing south to north. This is a cycle that continues because of activity on both sides of the border, and the United States will do our part to try to end this cycle.
The Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, along with the other leaders of the U.S., as he mentioned, in Mexico City, including the Attorney General, Merrick Garland. More from the Reuters article, U.S.-Mexico relations, they write, suffered a major blow last October when U.S. anti-narcotics agents arrested Mexican former Defense Minister Salvador Cienfuegos, outraging the Mexican government. Cienfuegos was freed, but the detention strained relations and hurt security cooperation. This year's Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to two news editors, one in the Philippines, the other in Russia, to highlight the issue of press freedom. The chair of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, Berit Riis-Andersen, made the announcement at a ceremony in Oslo.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Nobel Peace Prize for 2021 to Maria Ressa and Dmitry Muratov for their efforts to safeguard freedom of expression, which is a precondition for democracy and lasting peace. Ms. Ressa and Mr. Muratov are receiving the Peace Prize for their courageous fight for freedom of expression in the Philippines and in Russia. At the same time, they are representatives of all journalists who stand up for this ideal in a world in which democracy and freedom of the press face increasingly adverse conditions.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee Chair, Berit Riis-Andersen, today in Oslo. Washington Post reporting on the awards, writing, under Russian President Vladimir Putin, journalists have been assassinated and many independent news outlets have closed or been taken over by Kremlin-friendly oligarchs. Muratov's Novaya Gazeta is one of the few strong independent newspapers surviving in Russia. And in the Philippines, Ressa and her news organization, Rappler, have repeatedly been targeted through campaigns of online harassment and criminal charges, which have been widely seen as politically motivated under the direction of President Rodrigo Duterte. That's from the Washington Post. Maria Ressa, by the way, only the 18th woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize in its 120-year history. Today is the 150th anniversary of the Great Chicago Fire. The fire started October 8, 1871, in a neighborhood southwest of the city center following a long period of hot, dry, windy conditions. Over 3 days, it destroyed over 3 square miles of buildings, mostly built of wood, killed an estimated 300 people, left more than 100,000 residents homeless, about a third of the city. C-SPAN visited the Chicago Historical Museum several years ago, which had an exhibit on the fire, and it included a reenactment of the testimony of a witness, Ann Bauman. Here's a portion of that.
As soon as I got outside, I could feel that the fire was very near. And the air was hot, almost to the point of suffocation. It was full of black smoke and hot cinders. The sky appeared to be on fire as we escaped. The wind was blowing as strong as a tornado, and the air was full of burning boards and shingles, like flying in every direction. They were landing everywhere around us, and I held on to Mary's hand so tightly because I was afraid that she would be lifted up and taken from me. Everyone around us was in a panic, trying to escape with what they could. They were trampling everything and everyone in their paths. The middle of the street was jammed with carts, carriages, wheelbarrows, every sort of vehicle. And as we made our way north, the buildings around me seemed to be fine 1 minute and then ablaze the next. The crowd was in a panic, and it seemed that half of them were cursing their luck and the other half were praying. "Why is this happening to us?" someone shouted. "It's the end of the world, I know it is," screamed another. The newspapers say that the burnt out area of the city is almost a mile across and 4 miles in length, and that the water tower is practically the only thing left standing downtown. I've also heard that it's the only way for many people to know where they are in the city. But the real mystery is still how the fire started and why it was not put out quickly. I've heard some people say that the fire was started by a cow owned by someone named O'Leary. And supposedly, this woman was milking a cow in her barn when it accidentally kicked over a lit lantern. And that set fire to the hay inside her barn. And the fire in her barn ignited many other buildings in Mrs. O'Leary's neighborhood, which sent out dangerous sparks. These sparks spread the fire that turned our growing city into a blackened ruin. That is just so hard for me to believe. All of this is because of a cow.
Reenactment of the testimony of a witness to the Great Chicago Fire that started on this day in 1871, 150 years ago. Witness Ann Bauman, the woman portraying her, Erin Kathleen Carlson. This was at the Chicago Historical Society when C-SPAN visited back in 2001. You can find our full segment on that at our video library at cspan.org. And by the way, historians generally dismissing that story of Mrs. O'Leary's cow kicking over the lantern, sparking the blaze. In 1997, the Chicago City Council even passed a resolution exonerating both the cow and its owner. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. And for more top Washington stories, subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word, at cspan.org/connect. Hope you have a good night and weekend.